This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Hardcore is a new series from Heritage Radio Network. Over six episodes, we're taking a close look at the rebirth of American cider.
Really, it wasn't until about 10 years ago that cider started to be revitalized in the United States.
From the science of fermentation.
So yeast, it's a fungus. It's a unicellular fungus.
To the magic of terroir.
What really excites us is thinking about communicating that very sort of spiritual aspect of knowing a piece of land.
We're setting aside our cider donuts to gain a deeper understanding of this singular beverage.
I love a cider donut. You don't have to have a cider donut with your cider, and I will die on that point.
Subscribe to Hardcore wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're listening to Feast Meets West, the show tracing the stories behind your favorite Asian foods. I'm your host, Linda Liu. We are broadcasting live from Heritage Radio Network at Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Every episode, we dig deep on an aspect of Asian cuisine or culture by having a conversation with the passionate people from the world of Asian food. Today, we're talking to Matt Lecaque and Jimmy Tran of Bolero. Located in the heart of Williamsburg, Brooklyn, Bolero features a hyper-seasonal menu that emphasizes the rare, fresh herbs that form the foundation of Vietnamese cuisine. They are sourced from Matt's family farm in Pennsylvania and showcased in the restaurant's Vietnamese Tea Garden. Dear listeners, you may remember Matt from one of our first episodes where we discussed banh mi while Matt was heading up the kitchen at An Choi. After his tenure there, Matt has been absorbing whatever part of the Michelin world he can distill to the Vietnamese experience at the Finch and Blue Hill at Stone Barns. While cooking, serving, and farming, he spent several years also using his academic background to research the origins and lost traditions of his Vietnamese heritage. Here in the studio with us, we also have Jimmy Tran from the Bolero team, who is a chef and experienced designer. Jimmy is a graduate of the Greenbrier Culinary Apprenticeship Program and has worked in various restaurant and hotel kitchens across the country, including Bennu, Quince, Corton, and the Greenbrier. He also runs an experiential technology studio called Plus Ultra that uses emerging technologies to create interactive experiences and maintains a food design studio called Cosmophage Collective. Welcome, Matt and Jimmy.
Hey, it's a beautiful thing. Thanks for having us.
Hi.
Okay, so let's start with your new restaurant concept. Tell us all about it.
So we just wanted to build a dining experience where we can allow guests to experience the deeper cuts of all the beautiful things that make our Vietnam so enticing to even the most worldly travelers. And it's not only going to stop at the food, but the ceramics, the architecture, the way a Vietnamese person lives, or psyche, or MO. We're just excited to have this 50-seat restaurant with an open kitchen. And we're lucky enough to have a space in our backyard to do a Vietnamese tea garden, which Jimmy can talk a little about.
Please do.
Oh, absolutely. Well, our tea specialist that we have on board, Q Nguyen, who's not here with us today, he and I traveled with Matt to Vietnam recently in July for the entire month. And he's staying at this really magical Airbnb at a tea house. And in that tea house, he woke up every morning and there's like fresh lotus flowers all over the floor and an incredible service for just tea that's sourced primarily only from Vietnam and generally processed like in the tea house itself. And it was just an incredible experience for him, his coming from a financial background, And for myself, not knowing very much about tea at all, much less that there is Vietnamese tea as a culture and a big part of the culture in the North. And we had a really incredible experience and learned a lot from that. And we really want to share that with everybody here in New York as well.
Yeah, that sounds so exciting and different. Could you talk a little bit about what makes Vietnamese tea, Vietnamese tea? What's the signature quality to it?
Well, historically, tea in Vietnam has been used only in fresh leaves. They don't really dry it.
Fresh leaves.
Yeah, absolutely. So farmers would just pick leaves off trees, place them in a pot, and let them steep, go work out in the fields, and then lunch to come back and just pound that super heavy potion of, of energy.
There's just so much wild tea growing in Vietnam. It's amazing. And we also have one of the oldest tea trees.
Yeah, all the tea trees in Vietnam are primarily in the north of Vietnam, just south of Yunnan, where all the other teas grow.
Right.
But I think there's a lot of over-harvesting that happens in China, and in Vietnam, it's just not that way. And they're also in mountainous areas where it's very difficult to cultivate. So they've just been these heirloom trees just hanging around for so long. And there have been like scientific reports from some Russian scientists that say that that the teas, like the origin of the tea tree, the Camellia sinensis, comes from that region in Vietnam. So
expect some tea trees out back in Bolero, along with a showcase of relevant foliage and plants and herbs that the guests will soon discover inside when they dine.
All right, let's jump to that. Tell us about some of the fresh herbs and plants we'll find in this garden.
I think it's really interesting because, like, when you first interviewed me at An Choi,
That was like 3 years ago.
Yeah, there was this beautiful moment where there's like a blooming of the Vietnamese American led restaurants.
Yes,
you know, like An Choi was like the one of the four, like their first salvo out there, and soon after Bunker and Bricolage and Hanoi House and Vanda D&D, like there's so much beautiful things, and you know Bolero is going to be built off those that bedrock. That's exciting times to be in New York. So we're going to take advantage of that. And back then, it was one of the first things I wanted to do at An Choi was to use the right herbs. Most Vietnamese restaurants, if you're eating pho back then, you have the herb plate, which is such a quintessential element of Vietnamese cuisine.
Right.
Unfortunately, on those herb plates, there's this bean sprouts, jalapeno, cilantro, and Thai basil. Thai basil is great. Yeah, bean sprouts, great. Jalapenos, on the other hand,
it's just so easily accessible.
It's just so easily accessible, so they use it. But what we really want to see is like Thai bird chilies, and it's you know, when Vietnamese first settled here in America in this new diaspora, they couldn't find culantro or sawtooth herb, which is the actual herb that goes in beef pho. Beef pho, just like so hearty and like it's hot. Like you just throw cilantro in it, it just wilts right away. But culantro can like hold itself up to that intense beef flavor. So one of the first things that we did at An Choi was like to push that herb. And soon after we saw it at Bunker and Hanoi House, which made me so excited.
Trend.
To see, you know, that pushed forward, you know, so that was the climate back then for sure.
And now you are actually growing these herbs as well, and you have a farm for that.
Yeah, I think it was just out of frustration of
I will solve this problem and take it in my own hands.
I grew up in Philly. I have a lot of relatives out in Westminster, Garden Grove, out in Southern California. When they have to buy Vietnamese ingredients, the size of their grocery stores is bigger than Whole Foods or bigger than Trader Joe's. Over in New York, there was two bodegas selling all the herbs we needed, you know, as a consumer.
Where were those bodegas?
It was deep in Chinatown, Grand and Barry.
Those are the coveted streets. They're like sold out of one thing.
Yeah,
it's like,
and you know, like sometimes they're all bruised and like, no disrespect to them because like that was like the only source back then. And we were totally grateful.
Yeah.
But at some point as a chef, you want to control the quality of your ingredients. And to this day, I haven't had fresher, greener lemongrass than the ones from my farm. And or winter melon that tastes as juicy or as big as the ones from what we're growing right now. So I think that was one of the main driving forces, or it was a necessity to actually try to grow these. And I think my time spent at Stone Barns was very pivotal in that movement. Mm-hmm. It's like how I was farming, I was like running food out, I was cooking, but the one that stuck to me was like the just like how you look at like a landscape. Mm-hmm. Like I used to be like, oh, that's just all weeds. But now, like after just being through all this amazing restaurants, like, oh, stone crop, like that grows on like my koi pond in my farm. I never realized you can sell that for like $20 a pound, you know, Union Square Market. So it's like I see when I walk into a field a little different.
That's really cool.
It's an amazing thing.
And how long have you been farming now in your Pennsylvania farm?
I grew up on that farm.
Okay. Was it always Vietnamese produce or herbs?
Yeah, because, you know, like, I didn't really think about, like, oh, organic, sustainable. Mm. Before these words became into the lexicon, like, my parents just grew it out of pure necessity. Like, mm-hmm. we're not going to be able to mm-hmm. find this, so we're going to grow our own fish mint or beetle leaf, you know? So I've been absorbing that, but then now I know, like, how it affects a really great dining experience, like
you've product, grown up with it,
you know, and like it now, like it's like focused into this new endeavor called Bolero. So it's a very beautiful thing to have that.
Really cool. And so, what was that seed point for Bolero? Is there like a origin story for that initial seed?
Seed. You want to take this, Jimmy?
Yeah. I mean, I think this is something that's been. I've been thinking about a lot in Vietnamese cuisine overall in New York. Living here for 6 years now, I've never seen it represented in a really enticing way overall. And I've always thought it'd be really nice to bring like these dishes from like my childhood and the things through my travels, these regional dishes, to New York to share with everybody. And I met Matt randomly at an event, and he was talking about thinking about opening a restaurant of this sort, and we kind of just vibed. And we talked about things that we really liked about Vietnamese culture and about cooking overall. And mm-hmm. I think that really, really got us really excited. And Matt just went gung-ho and put down the money for Elise and just started this thing. And so we've been collaborating together, and it's been a lot of fun.
Cool. And how do you guys split up your roles? What are each of you responsible for in this project?
I think it's a beautiful relationship we have right now because it's almost a reciprocal, our two paths in our career. Mm. I started off in Vietnamese food, and the only thing I was thinking about was Vietnamese food. And it was a really beautiful period at Anh Chơi. But at some point, I wanted to see other kitchens and what like the urgency, the passion for food, the importance of food, the attention to detail that I can mm-hmm. bring from my other experience in other kitchens down to and distill it into the Vietnamese level. Mm-hmm. So Jimmy is the reciprocal of that. He trained very heavily in French techniques for quite a while.
And I rejected Vietnamese cuisine for a long time. Yeah.
Wow.
I grew up with the flavors.
Asian-American identity story there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I never really identified as Vietnamese for a very long time. Mm-hmm. But I love the flavors, and I've come back around to it after traveling to Southeast Asia. And it's been really incredible just kind of seeing it from a fresh perspective, bringing this classical training that I've been given and like just sharing it with my family. And it's just really fun talking to my mom and making these things with her. And she's like, oh, that's like a super Vietnamese technique as well. You know, like these pâtés and like this baguette and all this stuff. So for me, it's like meeting Matt and his like super deep contextual knowledge of Vietnamese philosophy and culture mm-hmm. have really inspired me to think more about Vietnamese cuisine in a really interesting way that I'm really excited about.
Awesome.
Owning it.
And what about the name Bolero? What does it mean? And how did you guys land on that?
So Bolero was the most popular dance form when my dad was in Saigon, growing up in Saigon. When he was like a teenager in his 20s, like that was the most happening dance. So mm-hmm. when you go out at night, you would be dancing to Bolero, but it's a Vietnamese Bolero. Mm. So I wanted to just capture like what the MO of Vietnamese like life, art, creativity is. And I feel like Bolero is a good example of it because it came to Vietnam during the Indochine French colonial days. And back then, all the Paris salons would be You know, the madams would be hosting parties and they would be playing Cuban music. And eventually it got over to the salon parties in Vietnam. And the Vietnamese servants would be like, what is this music? Like, this is, like, we gotta learn this. And I feel like in my research on where the origins of, like, Vietnamese bolero came, it's almost like an urgency for Vietnamese to see, like, oh, our oppressors or our masters are playing this, like, very sophisticated music. We need to learn how to do this so we can be at their level. And then the Vietnamese, like, took it and then added their own traditions and music tradition to it and made it into their own beautiful Vietnamese bolero, which became so popular back in the 50s and 60s. And I feel like that captures, like, what we do with name any dish in Vietnamese cuisine, mm-hmm. and it's that same MO. We take a technique and we run it through the Vietnamese psyche, the MO, and then boom, in my opinion, create something more beautiful. So we wanted to capture that essence.
Awesome. Yeah. And so we actually have a clip lined up, so we'll go ahead and play that to get a little taste.
Can imagine my, like, dad in khakis and slick back hair.
Khakis,
dancing to that.
Yes.
Like, well, he was telling nice me linen. He used to, like, slick his hair back with beer because he had nothing else to slick his hair back with.
What?
So him dancing that music with beer in his head.
Also on the Bolero Wikipedia page, like, there's a specific section for Vietnamese Bolero, which I think is pretty weird and cool. It's like Latin American and then Vietnamese Bolero, and I mm-hmm. think that's really dope. Mm-hmm. What I really like about the name is that, like, looking at the cutting room floor of what we thought about the name could have been, we could have chosen, like, a super Vietnamese kind of name and made it look, like, really, like, obscure and, like, what one might call authentic, I guess, in a way. But mm-hmm. what I like about the use of the name Bolero is just, like Matt was saying, the Vietnamese MO, the kind of, like, spirit of the Vietnamese culture is to, like, really accept everything that happens to you and make the best out of it. And in a way, it's like all of these dishes that we're cooking and all the food that we're going to present is an acceptance of, like, colonization and all the historical things that have happened. And we're not trying to capture some authentic, like, version of Vietnam. Like, what I don't even know what authenticity is in that regard. Like, what time period, like, what subsection of people, what culture. But it's like a spirit of, like, this. These people came in and changed some stuff, but we made it our own and made it really great. And I think
also, like, the spirit in that name also triggers this response, like, oh, why Bolero? Mm-hmm. And we want you to ask why Bolero.
Yeah,
because that opens this, like, whole story and conversation. And we invite all our guests to come in and ask that question, not only about our name, but, like, everything you see in our restaurant.
Mm-hmm. What else? What else in the restaurant should diners be prepared to ask about,
yeah,
or
so
have the option? To?
Sure. I mean, we want to build this immersive experience where, I mean, if you want to come in for good food, yeah, you're going to get mm-hmm. great food.
That's just
layer one. But mm-hmm. if you're dining and you're like, oh, yeah, why is this, like, why is my rice bowl, like, cracked enamel like this?
Okay.
And that's like that rice bowl is from the most famous ceramic city in near Hanoi called Bat Trang. And, you know, if they see, like, oh, this, like, mosquito net's hanging from one of, like, the pendulums, why is it there? It's like, well, if you ever spent time in Vietnam and really go out to, like, the beach area or, like, the jungle area, you're going to be sleeping under a mosquito net, and that's part of our life, you know? So we wanted to, like, put these, like, elements of Vietnam in a context where it's, like, very accessible. Like, we didn't want to make a very Disneyland, like, we're going to force this culture down your throat. But, like, if you're intrigued by it, ask. And we'll be more than happy to talk about your, you know, everything about it. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. So there's the Vietnamese tea garden. There's the ceramics. There's the mosquito nets. What other elements or examples of this deep dive into Vietnamese cuisine and culture can diners expect? And it also sounds like you guys are drawing on influence from specific times and eras too, mm-hmm. which is not something we typically see of new Asian restaurants where these days I think it's great that folks are able to experience specific regional cuisines, but embracing elements of history, that's still something I think we're exploring.
Yeah, there's something about the nostalgic aspect of like, I went hell over high water to get this like one Vietnamese address sign. It's like the design on the outside of the facade, sign you see everywhere in old quarters of Hanoi and some parts of Saigon, and you know, like that is a straight lineage back to like Parisian streets too, which is like a dominant force in our history. French occupied Vietnam for 100 years, and we took a lot of beautiful techniques and beautiful culture from them. China, 1,000 years. And we took so much from them, too, and made it our own. So that's the story. That's the story. That's the Vietnamese story. Like, we always, you know, incorporate into and make it something our own.
I think we're really lucky these days because doing super regional cuisines is something that's pretty obscure and kind of hard to let diners grasp. But these days, everybody's just so smart. And I think people are willing to dig deeper into, like, a culture, a city, like a very specific region of mm-hmm. the country.
They're traveling more.
Yeah, and to know like the difference between like northern and southern Thai cuisine, the three parts of Vietnam and like the very, very distinct provinces of China. It's like super cool that people are interested in it overall. And I love that. And so far, everywhere that I've gone, I've told people about this restaurant and this concept. They've been super excited. And I never knew people would be just so deep into it. I met this really cool ceramicist in Maryland, and he's like this incredible wood fire potter, and he was just telling me like about Vietnamese ceramics, and he showed me this really cool book and the ancient like separate tradition of Vietnamese ceramics that I've never known about. And it's just something that gets people really excited, and I love that there's so much knowledge being passed around and energy and vitality and like the want to learn more about this culture.
Yeah, wow, super exciting.
Yeah, there's also this thing about like the grass is always greener on the other side of the fence, because from like a Vietnamese American's perspective, like we're so intrigued by this history or lost fading culture of Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. As children of immigrants.
Yeah. And while the kids out in Vietnam, they only care about like Justin Bieber, you know, like, or like,
they love
like
Justin
exposed
Bieber.
Brick and beer houses and stuff like that, you know, like, while like traditions like one of our dishes we're going to have is called morning dew rice paper. And so it's almost like when you come in, when you sit down, we're going to present dishes most people know already, but they haven't seen it in this form or truer form or more deeper form of it. Meaning the way people have eaten guai guang or summer rolls or salad rolls or spring rolls or whatever the American nomenclature of it right now is always been pre-rolled.
Yeah.
You know? And at a Vietnamese table in Vietnam, it's a different story. Like it's the way Vietnamese eat at a table is very modular.
Mm.
There's whatever grilled proteins they have is in front of them, and it comes with a lush herb plate, which is like the quintessential element of Vietnamese cuisine. And from it, you pick like if you want to make it more, you know, you can compose each bite and make it your own. So most of the time, Vietnamese would have rice paper, and they would have to dip it into water to make it malleable enough to roll. If you've never done it before, it can get a little sloppy, you know. But you know, you can do it for sure.
Right.
But I feel like even Vietnamese people are forgetting about this like next layer of rice paper called morning dew rice paper, which is it's so delicate that they say like the morning air is enough to make it malleable. So, you know, like I remember one of my first experiences at eating at Empeyon. It was the first time I like ate form a taco at the table, which is like, it was like, oh, this is great. Like
Assemble it fresh,
you know? Yeah. And it's, if you can do that, if you can form a taco, you can use this morning dew rice paper and eat grilled prawns, nam lua, which is a Vietnamese grilled pork, and if you want to make it more spicy, you add some Thai bird chilies. If you want to make it more citrusy, you add star fruit. If you want to make it more bitter, you add some mustard greens. If you wanted to make it more fishy, you add fish. There's so many options to control
your
journey,
own palate.
Your journey through this, and you have the agency to do it.
Yeah.
And that's the Vietnamese way of eating.
Mm.
And I feel like it's getting there, but you know,
sure.
like it's ready to like get more agency to mm-hmm. the
diner. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah
the diner,
and you
yeah.
guys are pushing it in that direction.
Yeah,
that sounds really
yeah.
cool.
We want to, you know, like this stuff is disappearing even in Vietnam. You know, it's like it almost takes like a New York restaurant or something yeah. outside of Vietnam to actually preserve it, like a museum almost. But like I hate using the word museum because it's like, you know, like there's no invention or innovation. There'll be plenty of it
mm-hmm.
at the restaurant, sure.
Yeah.
But,
what I'm excited about also when I hear this is the experience and story you're giving to each diner. So then as they're learning how to, you know, wrap or fold their own summer rolls, they can pass on that knowledge to their friends.
Yeah, pass on that fire, that torch.
yeah. yeah.
Absolutely.
So hopefully that tradition keeps going
yeah.
then.
Yeah, absolutely.
Awesome. So we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back with more Feast Meets West.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the 2 Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Feast Meets West. So Matt, Jimmy, what does the menu look like? How should diners engage with the menu at Bolero?
Well, everything in the menu is going to be shared and be given this sense of agency so you can kind of enjoy things the way you want to in this kind of French bistro kind of way, but also Vietnamese. But a lot of the menu is kind of a secret. And
What?
And if I told you, I'd have to stuff your face full of Morning Dew rice paper or something like that. I don't know. I just feel like...
Fighting words there.
Yeah, like, that's an interesting way to
yeah, I don't know.
Die. chew my way out of that.
No, I think like, it's going to be a smaller menu, like, maybe 15 uh-huh. Dishes.
But will there still be like, a small plates, large plates section, or really everything is mixed together? And
yeah, I think there's a gradient of just how large or small something is, and
okay.
we'll just have them all yeah. on the menu, and you just pick and choose what you think is appropriate with some guidance from
yeah.
our wait staff.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's like so many dishes we want to like do and present at Bolero, but we're gonna let like whatever's from the farm or whatever we see in the Union Square Green Market dictate, like, okay, what do we do this week? What do we do today?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's exciting?
Mm, so it'll be like a very fresh weekly.
We'll
expect
let that
a
be
lot
the
of
driving force of it
changes.
For sure. Yeah,
great.
Absolutely, because we want the ingredients to be like at its peak when we use it in whatever dish that needs it. You know?
Yeah. Do you think there's going to be dishes on there that you'll have almost year round, or like really popular things that you'll always want as a staple on the menu? Or again, you know, that's going to be all dictated by the forces of nature.
I mean, it's like, yes, absolutely. I mean, there's always going to be some like grilled proteins or pork belly or something like that. But you know, the seasons would dictate the herbs that surround
the
it,
herbs,
right? So
right.
it's always going to be some variations of it, but we'll let it dictate, like, you know.
And in terms of sustainability, I think just writing the menu and having something that's the same protein or the same type of vegetable throughout a whole year just seems like not the right way to approach the cuisine. Yeah. That is, I mean, in Vietnam, like, there's kind of no seasons, but here...
Well, yeah, there's it's a really long season.
Warm and warmer? Or
yeah, warm and, like, hot and, like, inundating heat. Like, right. It will dry everything out. But, you know, like, the lots, like, one of the main... farming regions of Vietnam, and their season is like almost a two-season kind of system. But yeah, I mean, we definitely took a lot of inspiration from when we went out to Vietnam, and I've been to Vietnam many times, and many times as well. But we never like went behind the scenes of the food industry, the farming industry. I didn't really have a plan at all. I was just like, I just had a round trip to Hanoi. And then a round trip back, whatever. And I just wait until like, hey, Matt, if you can be in the lot Tuesday morning, I'll show you around my organic farm. Mm. Or if you were around, I can show you down in my farm outside the skirts of Saigon. And it's like, really just like that it was very exciting to have that mobility because each day is like, we could be on an island, you know, tasting fish sauce from a barrel, from like a 9-month barrel, 12-month barrel, whatever, you know. So it was really interesting experience for sure. And it was really nice because like, let's see, one of the trips I went to Organic Farm, I saw Dan Barber's third plate book on his table. And this dude, he was sleeping in a treehouse and he still had like the third plate on the table. I'm like, dude, like, let's like talk, you know, like, and he's doing like cover crops and, you know, rotations. And it was beautiful to see it like cross-fertilization of American and Vietnamese, like, you know, so yeah, that was the driving force for sure.
And I remember from one of our earlier conversations, you mentioned no banh mi or pho on the menu. Is that correct?
Yeah, I feel like...
No?
Yeah. You have some? No. I feel like a lot of great restaurants are doing great versions of that. And we don't need to push that envelope further because it's already taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
And we also wanted to start the discourse of like, we want people to try more things. And I feel like as long as you have this like one dish meal in front of you. I mean, it takes a lot for a guest to come out and dine out in New York. It's very expensive, you know, like when you go out and spend one night, it's like, oh, can you risk trying a whole new dish and maybe you'll like it, or maybe the taste is too weird for you and it will just ruin your night. So the way we want to design the menu is like, you can order three dishes you recognize and maybe two dishes that are maybe a little bit more adventurous, and the margin of risk is a little less. So
we want to balance your portfolio of risk.
We want to set it up as so it's a win-win situation, so people are very adventurous and can try new things. So.
Yeah, I like that interpretation. So I'm so excited to try this. When are you guys opening?
Well, if you sign up at bolero.nyc, you'll be the first to know.
Oh, excellent. And so tell me a little bit more about what the interiors will look like. So, you know, how big is this tea garden? And you'll have an open kitchen, right? How will diners kind of interact with the space?
So the tea garden is 150 square feet, and the restaurant overall is around 50 seats. But the interior is essentially just like a really giant open kitchen with a bar area. So you're like really close to the action and you get to interact with the chefs, and we want the chefs there on staff to be able to talk to you and tell you about the dishes they're making as well and what's important, what's cool about them. In the back we'll have kind of a waiting area for people that are waiting for tables, or after dinner you can join us for tea and dessert, which will be really exciting. But what's really great, I think, is we've been working with this really cool architecture firm called LeWitt.
Yeah.
Shout out to LeWitt. What up?
Yeah. We managed to convince them when they're not renovating the MoMA, the new MoMA design, to work on our restaurant.
Wow.
So, it was really nice to have them around because, like, we have just so many ideas of, like, what we want to throw into the design, and they were, like, a nice filter to, like, okay, that will work. We can design it this way, or we can recontextualize it in this way. So there's definitely elements there, but in a more modernized way, like For instance, like the tiles that we were just talking about before the show started. It's like we ship tiles from and breeze blocks from Vietnam. But it's not like the stereotypical tile encaustic tiling that you usually see. We had our friend Amy Wilder, who is an amazing pattern designer that I've known for so long, and I'm so happy to be able to get a chance to use her. And she designed the tiles to represent a feeling of the Mekong River, Mekong Delta, in the tile design. So you'll find out what I mean when you step foot into the restaurant.
I mean, what's really cool, I think, is just taking these elements of Vietnamese culture, the construction elements, and utilizing them in a way that's a little bit unusual and maybe a little bit more modern, I think. And I just love like having the architecture mindset with like, what is the overall design? What are we trying to communicate? And it's just like this feeling of Vietnam without this like complete importation of like kind of like copy
verbatim,
and paste.
Yeah.
That's not interesting to us, but it's a matter of like what is important to them and what how do they use these things and how can we use them in a way that makes sense for us. And it feels really
there's
cool.
A lot of like little subtle hidden designs around the restaurant that if you like, you know, when you're digesting or waiting for the table, you can look around, poke around, and
ask about anything.
Like I mean, like when you like first walk into the restaurant, well, when we took over the space, there was like the rolling gate, which is like a very New York thing. I'm just so tired of rolling gates. Like I want to like have that feeling of Vietnam. So took it all down and put the accordion scissor gate, which is a very big thing in Vietnam. So in Vietnam, like when you're in the streets, when you're like riding your motorbike through the streets, you're basically just, it's like a Wes Anderson like shot. It's like you're just passing people's living rooms and you just see right into them. Because the Vietnamese, like they park their motorbikes in their living room. And as soon as they finish watching TV, they get on their motorbike, like, let's go eat. They ride it out from their living room out into the streets, get to the restaurant, park it right in the restaurant, like boom, right in. So we wanted to capture that element of like, hey, this is the first impression you see of the restaurant. So like, boom, right away. Like, hopefully it's a unique thing, you know?
So we can park our...
Bring your Vespas.
Free parking. For people to park their motorbikes in front of the restaurant. It's so good.
That's going to be a gorgeous photograph. Yeah. All of Williamsburg's motorbikes outside, lined up on Bedford. Yes, and the Rebels. So it sounds like it's just going to be so, you know, rich in experience as a diner there. While I'm dining, I can ask about all of these different design elements and the food. Will you also be recording some of this research and these stories outside of the restaurant too? Do you have plans to?
Yeah, I mean,
you know,
like I feel like the restaurant would be one platform to tell the story.
Yeah,
I feel like we're all storytellers at heart, and we all have this like personal heritage to, especially the Asian American identity, to like talk about what makes us, you know, and. You know, the restaurant's one platform for people to come in and experience it. But, you know, like whenever we release a dish, we're going to do a story of it and break down like the herbs on the plate. So it won't be too confusing at first, you know? So hopefully, you know, like if you're ever like, oh, how do you eat morning dew rice paper? You can just go to our Instagram, like hit on that story.
Oh,
boom,
awesome.
Done.
Yeah.
Like hopefully it'll be a compendium for like, you know, like how do you eat this? How do you eat that? Or what's that song? Or how do you write a motorbike and fit five people and hold a baby at the same time?
We just want you to look really cool on your date. That's all.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. How to ride side saddle on the back of a motorbike.
Enablers. That's great. and then there's also, with your space, you have additional downstairs space too, right?
I think that's like a... So my parents are from Hue, and Hue cuisine is very prep intensive. There's going to be a lot of like wrapping in banana leaves and like
different stations.
Yes. Like we have a nice prep area that we can do a lot of stuff we want to get accomplished, and some secrets that we're going to release next year as well for the lunch program. So stay tuned for that. Maybe we'll come back to do a further deep dive into that area for sure. We just very excited to have the space to like tell the beautiful things about Vietnam, you know? It's like, tell our travels.
We're just so lucky to have that space. I think it's huge and so weird how we got it, and the location's pretty amazing. It's going to be great.
So you'll just be delivering secrets from the downstairs space upstairs to the mass public.
Yeah.
Ongoing secrets.
Mm-hmm. Well, the way it's like set up, it's like that definitely is the heart of the restaurant. But then the prep basin leads right into this open kitchen,
mm-hmm.
where we have all at least 19 guests sitting around the kitchen counter. And I think the kitchen counter experience is very important because we kind of want to break down that barrier between dining room and kitchen, and want to have that conversation between, you know, if a guest has noticed something intriguing or ingredient or a dish, like you can ask the chefs would take part in dropping the plates and whatnot.
Just like in Vietnam, you know, the people that are cooking are just right there hanging out, like inside of the dining room. Like there's no like bougie setup between like this back kitchen.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point.
Like waiters and stuff. So
when you walk into like the best pho restaurants in Vietnam, it's like the first thing you pass is like this fat old lady, like stirring this giant cauldron with a bunch of dogs walking around and like motorbikes whizzing around. So we won't have any dogs, but,
Yeah. taking freshness to the next level.
Yes.
Like immediate indulgence of the food.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That's great.
Absolutely.
So the Vietnamese food scene is really changing, like you said, Matt, over the years that you've been in this space now.
Yeah.
How do you feel about it? Do you feel like
I'm excited.
Yeah, going in the right direction? Is there still anything that's missing? What do you see for the future?
My first interview with Feast Meets West, and mm-hmm. the question was like, tell me more about this amazing sandwich called the banh mi, right?
Yeah.
And now we're talking about like growing our herbs and
so
it's like this in itself is an evolution in like the psyche of New York diners, and it goes to show how amazing your show is to like broaden that reach as part of
thanks.
The story too. So you know, I mean, like sitting in Roberto's, this is an institution right here.
Yes.
I had formative years here, like dancing a tiki disco outside and getting drenched until my iPhone didn't work. And like, it's so important. And like, I've been in the city for 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
The city has given me so much. And it's so exciting to be able to give back to the city somehow, you know, and hopefully the story and with Jimmy by my side, we can rock and roll and see what happens here.
Or Bolero.
Or Bolero, yes, yeah.
Oh, yes, I'll need a tutorial on how to dance Bolero, please.
I think my dad will be assistance
on staff, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
We need that tutorial video from him. And what do you think you'd like to see for the restaurant in terms of milestones in the year to come?
I mean, I really just want to do and execute our concept really well.
Mm-hmm.
So primarily, I'm just going to focus on that. I would love to see more from other people, but I think for us, we just want to like share tea and have a good time and share the foods that we love and that I think other people will love as well together.
Yeah. I think that's one of the reasons why I got into cooking is that you have this immediate joy when you drop mm-hmm. a plate in front of
that gratification.
Someone, right?
Mm.
And I think that's what we're living for. And to put like milestones up ahead, then you'll never enjoy what's in front of you, right? And I think that's the main reason why I got out of science. If I stayed there, it would be like 20 years of like focusing on one drug and then it may or may not come out, you
submit
know,
one
so,
paper.
You know, yeah. So it's like, it's a beautiful thing to have this like create something, drop in front of someone, you see the smile on their face. I mean, I remember the one of the pivotal moments in my life is we had my first pop-up at Anh Choi and I'm so grateful that it gave me that experience. And my mom always wanted to open a Vietnamese restaurant, but, you know, she was very selfless and, like, took care of my brother Long and I growing up, and she never got a chance to do it. And to invite her up and have her see all her dishes making people smile, like, it was such a beautiful thing, you know?
I'm
so grateful for that opportunity. And, you know, like, one of the catalysts is, like, you know, I had that moment, and then she passed away, and I got my PhD, and, like, what do I do? You know, like, it's like, I just turned 32 at that point. I'm like, oh, man, like, what is my path? Like, what is... And, you know, like, if you come into Bolero, eat the food, you'll know my mom. Sure, it's a beautiful thing. You know, I'm so grateful for that chance, you know. It's like, you know, our entire history is within our bones, and we have to, like, represent it somehow, you know, in some form of creativity, so...
Mm-hmm.
That's so great. I love that story. All right, before we wrap up the show, I have a round of quick fire questions for you guys.
Ooh. Lightning round, huh?
Yeah, it's meant to be just fun and fast, so just share what comes to mind first. What's the best thing you ate recently? It can be out, it can be at your restaurant during testing, menu testing, or at home.
Oh, that's a good question.
At Contra, I recently had this incredible tofu dish with smoked maple syrup, toasted buckwheat, chive, and caviar. Fucking banging.
Yeah,
so, yeah, it was really great.
Unexpected combo.
Yeah.
That's amazing. I was actually at D&D recently, and they had this, like, ant chili salt off menu that kind of blew my mind.
Oh, so, yeah, that was
much
really
respect.
Good.
Yeah.
All right. Do you guys have a favorite restaurant in New York? New restaurant, or it could be a classic, or both.
I'm a really big fan of Juju, the Korean ramyeon place.
Yeah.
And I think I got a lot of inspiration for the format of, like, the presentation of the dishes from the chefs from what I saw there.
Oh, cool!
It's amazing. So. Shout out to them.
Contra.
Nice.
Yeah.
For a first-timer visiting Vietnam, what's a place you would recommend as a must-eat or a must-see?
That's interesting.
This is a little kind of like too popular of an opinion, but I think the egg coffee is pretty incredible. I'm not a big coffee drinker, but I think that's just really good in Hanoi.
Why do you like that?
I mean, I love, you know, custards and sabayons and things like that. So this kind of, like, variation on the French technique in a Vietnamese way to make this really weird egg coffee where based on, I mean, they didn't
necessity,
have... Necessity. They didn't have milk, so they just like, oh, I have this egg. I'll just whip it up with some stuff and make it thicker in the way that I want to. And it became this really incredible, delicious, popular...
Love that.
Yeah. And I love it.
I would say taste 9-month... old age fish sauce from Red Boat Fish Sauce Factory in Phu Quoc.
Oh, nice.
It's one of the most profound.
Is it open to the public?
You can, they do tours
or,
for
yeah,
sure.
But
luckily, I worked with Gung before doing marketing for them. And when he heard we were coming out to Vietnam, he was like, Matt, if you can make it by this Saturday, show you around.
Super cool.
I booked us all tickets.
Oh,
we flew out there.
It's so sick. Yeah.
It was one of the most profound. Yeah, meals. It's interesting to, like, I don't know, like, the Asian, like, as Asian Americans, we hang out with, like, if I hang out with a Vietnamese person in America, I would be speaking English to the, especially an older person, but, like, out in Vietnam, like, we were just joking in Vietnamese, and it's, like, a totally different personality, and, like, I saw a different side of this,
nice.
You know, big boss man of Red Boat Fish Sauce, you know?
Yeah.
So he invited us to his estate, I guess you would call it, and he had his factory next door, and he had a team just put together one of the best meals I've had in all of Vietnam.
It was really good, yeah. They say it's like 1,000 square feet, maybe.
There's this, fermented anchovy sauce that I'm always kind of scared trying out in Vietnam because every time I go out of Vietnam, like, I'm 2 weeks in, I'm doing fine, I haven't gotten sick, and I'm like, okay, I'm going to do shrimp paste. I'm going to do fermented anchovies. Like, and as soon as I did it, I get sick immediately. But this is the first time I had fermented anchovy paste and did not get sick, and it was, like, one of the best meals I've had.
Yeah. I mean, seeing the process of how he makes that fish sauce is also super inspirational and incredible, and I think it's perhaps you didn't have quality stuff, but this was...
Oh, absolutely!
Stuff.
I trust this stuff. Yeah. Like, that's like if this one
like
place I should try this.
Stomach.
Like, if they made it, I'll definitely do it.
Yeah,
you know. So we tried like 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, 12 months.
We're just taking shots of fish sauce.
Yeah,
you know? Fish sauce.
It was pretty amazing.
It's great.
Yeah, it was just like he was just showing us around this beautiful, like, tropical island called Phu Quoc that used to be a prison colony, but now it's like a resort. You know, and just going around that island was like just hanging out with the de facto mayor of that island. Like, everyone was just so grateful for, like, the job opportunities he's given us. I remember we went to taste, like, fresh rice noodles. Like, oh, can you take us a spot? And he's like, yeah, I got you. And we're just slurping noodles, and this fisherman, like, this 60-year-old fisherman sitting next to us is like, your voice sounds so familiar. And Gung's like, oh, you're the guy who sold me like 2 tons of black anchovies that one 3 years ago.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
But we never actually met face to face. We just radioed through like the satellite phone. I'm like, so it was like nice to like just hang out with like someone that's helps this community out so much. Mm-hmm. And hopefully we can do something with that in Bolero. You know, like if anyone wants to learn more about Vietnamese techniques, come and we'll
have a glad conversation.
To have you.
Yeah.
Either cooking or eating or whatever, you know.
So I'll remember your face, your voice. We'll have a conversation.
Yeah.
It's going to be great.
So.
Amazing. All right. That wraps up our show. Thanks for everything, you guys, and for sharing your stories, Jimmy and Matt.
Yeah.
Thanks for having us.
Beautiful thing.
Thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in. As always, we appreciate your support. It would mean so much if you could leave us a rating or review wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back with our last 2019 conversation from the world of Asian food on December 11th, so don't miss it. Feast Meets West is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to find out more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.